got to talk about spirituality and happiness. And I have a certain sort of qualification about spirituality, because some years ago I was in America, in Boulder, Colorado, with an American lady, and she introduced me to a Lakota Sioux, Lakota Native American medicine man. We talked later on. I was back in Britain, and she called me up and said she talked again to him, and they talked about me. And he said, Rod Burstall is not a spiritual person. So I have some qualification to speak about spirituality, you see. Can you hear me okay? Yeah, okay. And the way she said it, I was a bit pissed off, because the way she said it was, he says you're not a spiritual person. I thought, she's so happy that I'm not a spiritual person. I was really pissed off. But I have sort of hung in for a while with the Tibetan tradition. The reason I came here partly was because I was asked to give a joint talk with a lady whom I didn't know at that time about Ibn Arabi. I'd actually been in Cordoba once, and been to a beautiful house there, 11th century house, and bought a book about Ibn Arabi. And the book was called Sufis of Andalusia. And he said, well, sort of, I'm writing this book because, part of the book, what's it called? Ru'al Quds. So he wrote this book saying that, well, somebody told him there were no proper spiritual people around these days. And he said, yes, there are. So he wrote a book about various teachers, which is a nice book. Jane also mentioned Akon Rinpoche, who was here, was clearly a very, very great man, and died very suddenly, was murdered in the Tibetan part of China. And that's just tremendously sad. My connection was with Trungpa Rinpoche, who came out of Tibet and came to Britain 50 years ago with Akon Rinpoche, the two of them, and they both came here to Sami Ling and set up the center in Sami Ling. And they had very different lives, because Akon Rinpoche carried on in the classical Tibetan tradition, and Trungpa Rinpoche went to America after a while, and he hung out with the hippies. He decided that the trappings of Tibetan, the formalism and the wearing his robes were actually getting in the way. People were saying he's an exciting person. He's a Tibetan monk. Look at that, you know. So he went to America and he hung out with the hippies very, very literally. He sort of opened his house to the hippies, and I needn't tell you the details, but it was pretty what they might call a wild scene. So he went from his Tibetan culture to the Western culture of Scotland, which is not terribly hippie-ish even at that time. And then he went to this other culture, and he sort of blended into that. And really, it was kind of too bad for the hippies, because he wound up making them wear suits. I've got a photograph of them standing up like this, and they're three-piece suits, waiting for the Karmapa to arrive. And he made them do the Viennese waltz. And, you know, really, I think he won over the hippies. So he's very interested in culture. And he'd seen the Tibetan culture, he'd seen culture in the West. So he was really trying to do something new. He was actually a Mahasiddha, so he was a very powerful person. And the way that manifested itself to me was the effect that he could have on your mind, because very much the Buddhist tradition is about working with mind. And these great teachers, and I've met several of them, can have the effect of producing, just changing the feeling in your mind. When you're with them, when you leave, you notice the change. There's a sense of, I can't put it into words, but there's a sense of great peace in your mind, or warmth, or something. It's very, very difficult to say. And that was really what intrigued me, and which I think is a long tradition in Tibet of such people. And I just didn't want that wisdom or knowledge or whatever it is to disappear from the world. And so I've been practicing, studying for a long time, not really to get myself happy, but because I had this feeling that it would be very sad if all that power and wisdom were to be lost. Trying to think which way around to put things. So he was a very great person. And there's a connection with what we're talking about here, which I found out only in the train the other day, reading the documentation. It reminded me. When Khrungpa Rinpoche died, he died in 1987, his son took over and became, after a little while, he was only 20 when Khrungpa died, and became our main teacher. And his name is Mipham, and he's called Sakyong Mipham. And this struck me as really interesting, because if you've read the, or you've heard about the this report about world happiness, about 40% of it, I think it said, was occupied with the kingdom of Bhutan. The king of Bhutan, the small principality next to Tibet. And my Trungpa's teacher, when he was in India, before he came to Scotland even, was Khyentse Rinpoche, who was one of the very great teachers. And Khyentse Rinpoche bestowed on the king of Bhutan the title of Sakyong. And Trungpa Rinpoche's son is called Sakyong Mipham, because he has the same title. So Khyentse, first of all, bestowed the title on the king of Bhutan, and then he bestowed it on Trungpa Rinpoche, and then Trungpa Rinpoche passed it on, as it were, to his son Mipham. What does it mean? It means earth protector. So somehow we have this curious lineage of earth protectors. So what are these people doing? Well, what Trungpa Rinpoche developed was a teaching called Shambhala teaching, which is very much about what you've been talking about how we connect with this world and how we experience this world. So from the Buddhist point of view, whatever is happening in our lives is not the immediate cause of our distress, because we kind of interpret it through our minds. So if you train your mind, you can go through all sorts of conditions without being overcome by them or distressed by them. It doesn't mean to say you wouldn't get angry or happy or sad. It's not a matter of not having any life, but it's a matter of being connected with the world as it is. So Trungpa Rinpoche gave a teaching about that. It's called Shambhala teachings, about being what he called a warrior in the world, a non-aggressive, gentle warrior with confidence and compassion. And he had the idea of bringing into the West the tradition of an enlightened society, and the sort of myth or whatever story that somewhere in near Tibet there was a place called Shambhala, which had a society which was an enlightened society. And so the Sakyong is now trying to, Sakyong Mipham is trying to work very hard to put into practice the teachings that his father left on enlightened society. And so this is not an idea of just individual happiness, but individual well-being, because, as I think you also said, it's very hard to attain real spiritual realization in a society which is completely disjointed. So the idea is to have an enlightened society, not a society of enlightened people. So it could be just an ordinary society. But what is it in society that is conducive to an enlightened world? And the good thing about this is that Sakyong doesn't have a plan. We've had sort of visions like this, so he doesn't know what it's going to be, which cheers me up a lot. But certainly it would be something where the basis for the society would not be acquisition. You know, we heard about the retail thing. It would be something where kindness is really the basis. The basis for relations between people, and there's a whole sort of Buddhist technology of how to acquire kindness. So, in Buddhism, the idea you can train your mind to be kind or have the other virtues. So, the society would be also have the underlying principle of what he calls basic goodness. So that we regard the world, you know, the society and the individual people as basically good. And everybody is basically worthy. So this is very far from the way that we often think of people, the way we're trained to think of people. And last night we heard about the retail advertising is actually to make you think you are not worthy, make you think you're lacking. And, you know, we hear all this stuff, which distresses me, about how the people, unemployed people, are unworthy. They're, you know, they're shirkers. And my granddaughter's been unemployed for a long time, so it just personally hurts me to hear this political rhetoric about people who haven't got a job are just not worthy. So the idea that worthiness comes from accomplishment or from money, having a lot of money, is far from it. And so if we can actually build a society where we just regard you, Lyndon, of course, you know, just the people in this room, you know, everybody here as worthy, not just we have a few words, conversation, and then that's it, but somehow each of us here is actually worthy. So that's 5 minutes to go. I think that's enough. Thank you very much.